Good afternoon. My name is Hope, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Illet Awareness conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Carol Gregory of Conservation Law Foundation, you may begin your conference.
Thank you so much, Hope. And I just want to welcome our guests who are here today, our members and supporters who have joined us by phone, and people that are logging in via Facebook. We are here. This week is National Lead Awareness Week, and here to discuss this topic, which is still very much an issue. I think people forget about that. We have with us Dr. Starro, Dr. William Starro. Dr. William Starro is a pediatrician at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Concord, and he's the immediate past president of the New Hampshire chapter of the American Association of Pediatrics. I want to make sure I got that right, so I'm reading it directly. We also have with us today Kate Kirkwood, who is the founder of Lead EDU, which provides lead safety certification training and information. And her first book is coming out this year, fingers crossed. Is Your Child Lead Poisoned?
Mm-hmm.
And then my colleague, Tom Irwin, who is the director of the CLS New Hampshire. That's where we are today, as a matter of fact, in that office. And he also sits on the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Commission. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Tom? Okay, great. So I wanted to, earlier before we got on, I was saying, I don't feel like I see as much. It used to be a big deal, National Lead Awareness Week. You'd see a lot of public service announcements about it. But it seems to have really fallen off of the people's radar, but it's still very much an issue today. Can you, Tom, speak to that a little bit on, what's going on and why are people not talking about lead poisoning and what is the status now?
Certainly. Well, the unfortunate reality is that lead is very much a problem. It continues to be a problem that affects children. I know we'll get into this in more detail, but, when children, particularly ages 0 to 6, are exposed to even minor amounts of lead, the consequences can be permanent and life-changing. I think part of the problem is people think that this problem has been solved. People realize that lead was banned from paint decades ago. That ban occurred in 1978. And I think as a result, people think problem solved, we've moved on. But the reality is that lead-based paint remains in housing throughout the country and in places like New England where we have a significant amount of aging housing stock, pre-1978 housing stock. That threat is present and it's real. So it is an ongoing problem.
What are the, Dr. Starr, can you talk a little bit about what the health impacts are for children who are poisoned?
So the big concern is cognitive impairment. And it may be subtle, for every couple points your lead level is up, you can knock an IQ point or two off. And some people say, well, it's not that big a deal. The big deal as a society is if you even knock 5 IQ points off of everyone, you have less geniuses and you have more people who are in the cognitively impaired range. On top of that, if you even personally have a little decreased intelligence because of lead poisoning, that can affect you, your prospects for college and future careers. So it can be a big deal. And then people who have significant poisoning can have really profound problems, everything from ADHD, memory issues, impairments of all sorts. The problem is, though, is most people don't have any symptoms. It's not like you can just look at someone and say, oh, I think you have lead impairment or lead poisoning because you're impaired. You don't notice it.
And Kate, can you talk a little bit about, some of the work that you're doing in terms of education and how you're getting the word out there to people that this is still a problem and how to recognize it and address it?
Sure. It's a significant challenge, as you know. So there's a federal law in place which says that if you are disturbing paint in a house built before 1978, you have to have some lead training. There's an 8-hour course that everyone is supposed to take if they're contractors or landlords or anyone who's making any money disturbing paint. If it's your own private home, you're not required to take the course, although I certainly would encourage everyone to take it. And the situation is that when they're disturbing paint, well-meaning contractors and do-it-yourselfers are creating this dust from the lead paint, which is then, you know, breathed in or inadvertently eaten by the children, and then they're poisoned. And, you know, this is such a small amount that they ingest or that they breathe that causes the problem. So we're trying to get the word out that you shouldn't be doing this work in a house built before 1978. In fact, as Tom said, we have the oldest housing stock in the country in New England, and if the house was built prior to 1940, 9 out of 10 of them have lead-based paint. So when you start scraping or sanding or cutting to do some kind of work in the house, you're exposing this hazard. So we want to teach people to do it carefully and to contain the dust that they create, and actually to stay out of trouble with the EPA, because in fact, if they're doing this work without this training, they can be fined and have other penalties with EPA.
I think it's interesting you're talking about paint, because I think the most recent story that we've seen about lead poisoning, of course, is the tragic circumstances in Flint. Mm-hmm. But what is the reality in terms of that exposure? Because I think that's what people are really thinking about, is the water exposure. Anybody can jump in. And
you want to take
that?
Certainly, I'll start. Happy to start on that. I think Flint obviously was a tragedy. Bad decisions were made, which led to significant problems with water quality and exposed a lot of kids to lead. I mentioned earlier that lead has sort of fallen off the radar screen for a lot of people, and I think Flint reminded people that lead remains in our environment and it is something we need to be concerned about. The reality is, in terms of exposures, lead-based paint and deteriorating lead-based paint continues to be the major source of exposure. We do need to be careful about our drinking water, and in fact, I suspect we'll get to some discussion later about legislation we're working on in New Hampshire, but we are looking at water as one source of exposure that needs to be addressed. But it is primarily lead-based paint that's the largest concern.
I do want to get to that. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say about the paint in the house. What a lot of people don't think about is you don't have to be doing a renovation to have a problem. Just living in an older home, we have what we call friction surfaces, where, you know, for example, an old window. You raise and lower that window, the sash rubs against that jamb area, and every day, and after a while, that paint is actually worn off. The doors, the windows, the baseboards where we bump it with the furniture, the steps that we walk on, and all those surfaces where we have some friction. But this is a heavy metal. It didn't disappear. When the paint left those surfaces, it went somewhere. And typically, lead is heavy, so it's not like some other hazards we know, asbestos that hangs in the air forever. Lead, actually, if we made a big lead mess in this room, within about an hour, it would settle out on the horizontal surfaces. It's on the floors, the windowsills, the countertops, and so forth. So then we have our toddlers and our babies, and where do they spend most of their time? They're on the floor. It's where they're safe, right? They can't fall off of the couch if they're on the floor. So we essentially put these children in the highest concentration of lead dust that we have in the house. And so we create this environment that's hazardous to them without even thinking about it, without having any kind of structured renovation or anything necessarily.
So now I'm a little overwhelmed. What do I do?
So the simple things you can do, even without doing renovations, thinking about the toddlers and infants crawling around on the floor, is clean your horizontal surfaces. Mm-hmm. Vacuum, mop, wipe down windowsills, door jams. Those are the friction areas where you're likely to see lead. Kids crawling around on the ground put their hands in their mouth a lot, too. As we get older, we put food in our mouth a lot, maybe, but not so much our hands. And so we're at less risk because we're not crawling around on the ground and we're not putting our hands in our mouth as much. So clean surfaces, water. If you're worried about lead solder in your pipes, if you let your water run a little bit before you make your drinking water or make your juice and things like that with your water, your formula, whatever you're doing with your water, let it run for a bit. Municipal water supply should have additives that helps the lead solder not break down and leach into your water. That was part of the problem with Flint, Michigan, mm-hmm. is they really had several things they did wrong, obviously. Part of it was the where the water was coming from to begin with, but on top of that, they weren't adding the appropriate additives to minimize that risk of leaching of lead from the solder. And so from a water supply perspective, running water, toys, few years back, a lot of us remember the toys, some toys from China have lead paint on them. Mm-hmm. It's nice and hard and shiny. It stays looking nice, but so being careful where you get your toys and some even pottery and things like that you might get in Central America or mm-hmm. from Africa and things can have lead in the paints on those. And so you really have to be careful what you're using for serving utensils or vessels and whatnot because there could be lead in those things. And so really trying to eat from something you feel is safe and not necessarily from third world countries that might not have the standards we have here.
And I guess if you don't really know, you should just err on the side of caution.
Mm-hmm. And Carol, getting back to something Dr. Storo said earlier, which is that, there often are no obvious symptoms associated with lead poisoning. A really important thing that parents should do is have their children tested, have their blood lead level tested. Unfortunately, in New Hampshire and in other states, we're not testing nearly enough kids. There are states that have universal testing requirements that require all 1 and 2 year olds to be tested, because if you can identify early on that there is a lead exposure happening, that allows parents to take action to protect that child and prevent further exposure. And this is actually something we're working on at the recommendation of Dr. Storo and the New Hampshire Pediatric Society, working to make New Hampshire a universal testing state.
Where, how does New Hampshire, do you know how we, as far as other states that are doing this, doing it right? Like, who can we learn from?
I don't think anyone is doing a good enough job, and every state sort of has its own strategy on how to deal with lead. Massachusetts, for example, CLF has done a lot of work on lead in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a great model for preventing poisoning from occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Other states don't have those sort of prevention measures in place. It's really a hodgepodge, but in terms of screening, I don't think any state in New England is doing a good enough job, and I'm most familiar with the New Hampshire data, and we are doing really a very poor job of reaching enough kids.
I'll jump in there for just a second. New Hampshire Public Radio did a thing a couple of years ago, which I'm sure is probably still available. I know we linked to it on our website, where they compared the screening rates in the surrounding states, and as Tom said, New Hampshire was just, I mean, our rates were, I think, at that time, 16%, roughly, whereas Massachusetts and Maine were testing 76 and 72% of their kids, Vermont, 82%. So we're not even in the same ballpark. We certainly have a long way to go in New Hampshire in terms of getting our kids tested.
Yeah, and I think if we really publicize and let parents know about this concern, they should be going to their pediatrician or family doctor and saying, I want my kid lead tested at 1 and 2 years old. Or if you live in an older home, more frequent than that. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that, too. So the part of the problem is when you're not a universal state, what's recommended is targeted screening. And targeted screening says, let me ask questions to figure out if you need a test. The problem with that is, as you can imagine, that can fall through the cracks when you've got the million other things to do at a visit. And when there's a high enough preponderance of lead poisoning, we should be a universal state to test every single kid at 1 and 2 years old. Then the next problem becomes, is the parent going to follow through and get the testing done? Because you can order the test, but if they don't bring the child to have the blood drawn, then it becomes a problem of they just didn't follow through with the test recommendation. Point of care testing gets around that, and that's actually testing in the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. Some offices are going to that, and I think it's a great model. I've been pushing my office to switch to that. We haven't done that yet, because then at the end of your visit for your 1 year or 2 year checkup, you have your lead result. And if it's normal, then great. You don't have to worry, at least for right now. If it's abnormal, then you do a follow-up venous test to see most accurately what the level is and figure out where to go from there. But point of care testing gets around the couple problems of, one, who do we test? Number two, did they wind up getting the test?
Okay, I just want to remind people before we continue with this conversation, really good information here, that we are going to be opening up the phone. So if you have questions, start thinking about what those questions are. And we also, if you have questions on Facebook, if you've joined us Facebook community, please just log in and type in your questions, and we'll be getting to those momentarily. Tom, let's get to that legislation that you talked about a little bit earlier. What is happening in terms of laws in New Hampshire, and what needs to happen?
Sure. So Senate Bill 247 is legislation that has been in the works for the past year or so. It comes on the heels of recommendations that came out of the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Commission. There were a number of recommendations that commission made about how New Hampshire's laws need to be strengthened to really be up to the task to address this problem. So the bill has been working its way through the legislative process. It passed the Senate. It is now in the House, and most recently, an amended version of the bill was voted on by a division of the House Finance Committee. And that amended version of the bill would do a number of important things. One, it would, as mentioned, make New Hampshire a universal testing state. So all 1- and 2-year-olds would be required to have their blood lead levels tested. Parents are provided the opportunity to opt out, but this will be an important move in increasing our very low screening rates in New Hampshire. Another thing the bill does is it lowers the regulatory threshold for the Department of Health and Human Services to go in and investigate properties when a child is diagnosed as being poisoned. Right now in New Hampshire, the regulatory threshold is 10 micrograms per deciliter blood lead level. The Centers for Disease Control, which takes great pains to emphasize that there is no safe level of lead exposure, has adopted the level of 5 micrograms per deciliter as the level at which health interventions should be taking place. So one of the important things Senate Bill 247 does is it lowers that threshold from 10 to 5 over a period of time to provide greater protections for kids.
Where is this bill meet? Where is it as far as the status of it? Like, what's the next steps, and
so,
how can people get involved who are interested in?
Well, great question, and we absolutely need people in New Hampshire who care about this issue to speak up in support of this bill. As I mentioned, House Finance Division 3 recently voted in support of this amended version of the bill. They've actually strengthened the bill since it came to them. They voted 8-1 in support of the bill. On November 8th, the full House Finance Committee, again, this is the New Hampshire House of Representatives, the full House Finance Committee will vote on the bill. And if they vote in support, then it will proceed to the full House of Representatives. So there absolutely are ways that people can engage and reach out to their representatives. Most important right now is for members of the House Finance Committee to hear from people. There are a few ways to engage. One is if you go to clf.org, you can sign up for our e-newsletters and you can get an action alert on this. Another way is through a website that we and other stakeholders have developed, which is called leadfreekidsnh.org. And if people go to that website, it's a great resource on the issue of lead. There is a big pledge button. If you mm-hmm. click on that and take the pledge, we'll keep you apprised of the legislative process and ways you can engage.
Great. Thank you, Tom. I just want to remind people again that if you have questions for our guests here today, to please, if you're on the phone, you hit *1 and you can get into the queue. And if you're on Facebook, just type in your question and we'll get to those momentarily. I have one question just out of curiosity, especially for the two of you, Dr. Starro and Kate. How did you get involved in this issue? What is it? Because you see a lot of things as a pediatrician, so what made you...
Sure. You know, I think one of the things we really try to focus on as pediatricians, and especially with my getting involved with the New Hampshire Pediatric Society, the New Hampshire chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, is prevention. I mean, it's one thing to treat things. It's nicer to figure out who's throwing the people into the river that you're trying to save from drowning so you don't have to keep saving them from drowning. Let's figure out how can we avoid that. And so whether it be avoidance of head injury through using bike helmets, avoiding lead by trying to remove it from the environment, and then trying to also detect when you're running into a problem is what really got me involved.
So I was a college professor teaching business courses and doing, you know, consulting projects on the side. And you may know, some of you may know the story, in the year 2000, there was a death in the city of Manchester. A two-year-old refugee girl, her name was Sunday Abeck, died of lead poisoning, which we have not had a death of lead poisoning that we know of, that we can identify, for years in this country, decades. But we had this one, and it was right here in Manchester. So the city of Manchester had gotten a little bit of funding to do something about this, and they were trying to work with local landlords to say, you know, we need to find out where the lead is in these properties, so we're offering some funding to help you with inspections and to actually do the work, to do the abatement work. And they were having a little trouble getting the word out, as we identified we are still, and having a little trouble getting landlords to kind of come to the table and take advantage of the program, so they hired a consultant to help them with this, and I happened to be that person. And I just got hooked on it. It was a problem that I knew very little about in those days, and when I started to do the research and heard the situation, I was appalled. I couldn't believe that we had this terrible crisis going on, this epidemic that people just don't know about. So one step after another, and EPA announced this law where everybody who's disturbing paint has to have this training, and I'm an educator, and I said I'd like to work in that field. And so one step after another. And I just want to mention one other thing, too, which is adults get lead poisoned as well. Mm. We worry about children, and obviously that's a primary concern because of the brain development and all the things that Bill can talk about much more eloquently and educated than I can. But I work with the contractors who get lead poisoned, too. And that's an interesting situation because OSHA requires, if you are an abatement contractor, that you get a blood lead level test periodically to make sure that your employees are not exposed to too much lead. So I get the call when there's an adult who is poisoned, and the contractors, you know, they want to get back to work, and their boss wants them back to work, but they can't until they figure out what's going on and lower the lead levels. So what we've learned is that adults do the same thing that kids do. We breathe it and we eat it. You know, that contractor who goes to work without paying attention to the fact that he's working with a lead dust and then sits down to eat his sandwich with his hands covered with lead dust poisons himself. Wow. And so a big part of what we do is education at that level as well.
And that contractor can bring home lead on his or her clothes and expose
the
children that way.
And there's certain other occupations, especially firing ranges, people who use guns, police officers and things. You can bring lead home from firing a gun repeatedly. Usually firing ranges are where we see that mostly. Lead smelting factories, battery factories and whatnot. There are places that have lead exposure. Luckily, not many people work at those type of jobs, but there are some. Munitions and firing guns is probably the biggest source for most parental jobs that we see.
Yeah, I think I'd like to hear from folks that have tuned in to the teleconference and or on Facebook Live. Hope, I understand we do have a question in the queue. Can you open up the lines?
Yes, your first question comes from the line of Paul Schwartz.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the great information about lead and its issues. I work for a new organization that's been 20 months in the making called the Campaign for Lead-Free Water. And I just want to say that EPA in the preamble to the Lead and Copper Rule says that 85% or more of lead poisoning, lead exposure for fetuses and for children fed with formula comes from water, not paint, soil, or dust. And so to say that lead in water is not a primary source of lead, I think is a little bit of misinformation. In addition to that, the way lead expresses itself in water, both dissolved lead and soluble, and dissolved or soluble lead and lead particles or chunks, is a little different than the way lead expresses itself in paint, soil, and dust. And for lead particles, you can flush for lots and lots of minutes. And in the next minute after you stop flushing, you can have a lead particle that's equivalent to 7 to 8 paint chips that sloughs off randomly or erratically into the water that you use for cooking or for drinking. And so I think that there's some review of the evidence-based, peer-reviewed literature that's necessary to really understand what it is that we're dealing with a ubiquitous source of lead that has not been addressed really at all. Corrosion control treatment, and that was talked about, is not sufficient to stop the expression of lead that's harmful at the tap, even if it's done correctly. So what I wonder is if any of the panelists have experiential or academic training about lead and water and about how lead and water and the lead and copper rule and the implementation and enforcement of that rule works. And I would challenge you, if you do, to go back and to read the peer-reviewed evidence-based material. And I would love to send to CLF and to anybody on the call a document that we produced called The Top 10 Myths on Lead and Water, which is heavily cited, et cetera. So I'd like to hear why it is that we're giving outdated information.
Okay, Paul, well, thank you for calling in, and let's give everybody a chance to respond.
Well, I think I'll respond in a few ways. One is that the Department of Health and Human Services in New Hampshire certainly continues to believe that lead-based paint exposures are the main problem, at least in New Hampshire. And they have actually started testing. They've teamed up with the Department of Environmental mm-hmm. Services, and they've started testing water any time they have found a child.
But their tests are not valid tests because they only do one draw or two draw tests. And Masters, in his peer-reviewed paper, said that because of temporal issues related to water and other water quality parameters, that to get within confidence of 20% of the actual mean value of the lead that would be expressed through any individual tap would take 1,200 tests. So the
other point,
HHS and others don't have the science
correct.
The
opportunity for our guests to also respond, and also, you know, we have other people that we want to get to those questions as well. So
I appreciate that, but inaccurate and non-scientific based information is being given on this call.
Two other quick points I'll make. One is that the lead and copper rule, my understanding, and this is in part from the Department of Environmental Services, is far from ideal in terms of protecting us from lead exposures, that the 50 parts per billion threshold in that rule is not sufficiently protective. So there is work to be done on this issue on the federal level under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the last point I'll make is that we are looking at the issue of water lead through water exposure in Senate Bill 247. It will require schools to test their water for lead. It will require public water supply public water suppliers to do an inventory of their systems and where lead is present. So it is an issue that we are addressing.
I would say I don't have any expertise or experience in what you're discussing, but do have experience in testing a lot of kids for lead. As much as we don't have a perfect testing mechanism, we test 70% of our one-year-olds, it should be 100%, and we don't see, if it were that rampant in our water supply here, we would see kids with positive tests, and we test two-year-olds as well. Now you say, well, they're not drinking much water. I would argue our older kids drink less and less water. They drink Gatorade and milk and juice that isn't concentrate and diluted with water. Our infants and toddlers drink the most water or formula made with water. out of any of our children. And so anecdotally, again, I don't have great data, but I would say all the kids that we test, we're not seeing rampant lead exposure. And the kids who do seem positive, have positive lead tests, there's usually paint sources. I'm not saying that water can't and doesn't cause lead poisoning, but I just can't believe that it's so rampant a problem that we're just missing, because we would see a lot of kids having this issue. And I do think that free-flowing water, when you look at the Flint data, I spoke with one of the investigators in Flint, presented at a meeting of ours. Their data of lead exposure in the water was so dramatically different when they stopped the corrosion protection and also a different water supply. And so free-flowing water helped, so it wouldn't have helped the Flint problem because the water had so much lead in it, wouldn't have made a difference. But the corrosion and water supply difference made a difference there.
I also can only speak from my own information, which is that I am a lead inspector risk assessor. So when I do an inspection on people's homes, specifically we're there to do paint. Usually we do an X-ray analysis of the paint. But often the homeowner will ask us to test water as well. So following the state protocol, we do first draw and we do a free flow sample. And although I have found some first draw samples that came back with lead, free flow I have not. And then that's only in my small sample, so I'm certainly willing to agree that it's likely to be a much bigger problem than I see. But the state, as Tom said, the state has been doing comparisons when they are doing water testing when they're in a property where they know a child has an elevated level for, I think, the last year now in combination with DES. And the last report I heard from them was that they had not found one poisoning case that they could link to the water as opposed to the dust in the house. So I have to say that our data in New Hampshire is perhaps not perfect, certainly, and we'll continue to work on that. As we are on the committee, we have people from DES working, you know, aggressively on this issue. But I think that our data right now shows our much bigger problem is actually the dust that we know of.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all so much. And thank you, Paul, for your question and for your comments. I want to go to Facebook. A little bit of a long question here from Tracy. Tires contain lead, and in the U.S., tens of thousands of synthetic turf fields contain a tire crumb rubber loose on the top of the field. This is essentially approximately 40,000 ground-up tires per field. Many fields are found at public schools. Should the lead content of these fields be considered for testing by the state? Should children using these fields be tested ages 2 to 20? The chemical substance of each field would vary based on the source of the tires. What can be done? Can leave it to any of you who want to tackle that one.
Well, I'm not aware of those ground lead tire fields being an issue. I would suspect, again, unless you're eating lunch right afterwards, it's not going to be as big an issue for the non-toddlers, the kids who crawl around on it more rather than running around on it with their shoes and not putting their hands in their mouth as much. So that's why we don't test older kids and adults so much, unless they have reason to suspect they're actually coming in contact with lead, like someone who's a painter or someone who works at a firing range, because we don't tend to ingest it as young kids do so much. It doesn't mean it can't happen. But it's a very interesting question. I was not aware that there could be lead in those tires, and is that an issue? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Tom or Kate does.
Well, I would just add one thing, which is that the labs that do our soil testing and our dust wipes will test anything. We could send a sample of those tires to the lab. I've had people ask to test the chicken eggs of free-range chickens. You know, we can test anything, really. So that would be, Tracy, if you would like to get that done, just any local lab that analyzes for lead could do that for you.
Okay, great. We have another question on Facebook from Josh. Preventing lead poisoning seems like an issue everybody should be able to get behind. Mm-hmm. What have been some of the barriers to getting elected officials to take action on this major health problem? Good question.
I have one quick response, and I'm sure there's others. I see adults come into my class all the time, right? They're contractors, they're painters, they're landlords, they're homeowners that, oh, I have to have this class. And sometimes they're forced to come by, you know, EPA or by their boss or whatever, and they come in and their whole attitude is, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is a ridiculous thing. We don't have any problem with lead anymore. We dealt with that years ago. I think from my perspective, the biggest problem is people not believing it's really a problem. And then those same people, honestly, when we show them the data, by, the 10 o'clock break, they're coming up to me with tears in their eyes saying, I might have poisoned my grandchildren. I didn't know. So it's about awareness. People just don't know. And what we don't know, we can't get behind, if that makes sense.
And I would just add to that, the political reality is that, at least in New Hampshire, the landlord community has been very concerned about the costs involved with better maintaining their units. And, they will be the most forceful opposition to Senate Bill 247.
Right. I understand we have a question on our telephone line. Hope, can you open up give us our next question?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 1.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought there was a question on. I thought there was somebody in the queue. My apologies. Okay, let's just see. We have another question here on Facebook. Another question here about what is being done in other New England states. Can you speak to the status of where we are in terms of laws and protection in our other states, Tom?
Well, I mentioned earlier that one of the things Senate Bill 247 will do is reduce the regulatory action level. Maine actually just took that very action last year. So in the state of Maine, legislation was passed to reduce their regulatory action level from 15 micrograms per deciliter blood lead level to 5. Again, 5 is the CDC's current recommendation. So that is a very important move that the state of Maine has made. They're protecting a lot more kids as a result, and is something that we hope to replicate in New Hampshire. I will mention that on the federal level, there's been progress with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which, as we know, owns a lot of housing, and they are now adopting that 5 micrograms per deciliter threshold as well in managing their properties to make them safer for kids. And finally, I'll mention that on the federal level, there is legislation, again, aimed at the Department of Housing and Urban Development to basically require more aggressive prevention measures to prevent kids from being poisoned in the first place. And I mentioned Massachusetts earlier. Massachusetts really, in some ways, is the gold standard in terms of preventing kids from being poisoned. In Massachusetts, if you're a landlord, you're not allowed to rent property to children unless that property has been made lead safe. Mm-hmm. And other states, unfortunately, have not followed suit. There was intense debate, actually, in the context of Senate Bill 247 in New Hampshire about similar prevention measures, adopting similar measures here. Politically, we've not been able to drive that primary prevention model home. One of the unfortunate things is we still are relying on kids becoming poisoned before the state can go into a property and address it, rather than requiring those properties to be made lead safe before kids are poisoned.
Okay. I thought we had another question on the phone, but I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly. Is there another question on the phone?
The line actually disconnected of the questioner, so they may have hung up.
Okay, and I'm looking on Facebook and trying to see if we have any other questions on Facebook. If I am not seeing a question on Facebook at the moment. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. We do have a question. In PG County, Maryland, there is still lead in the water in schools. The county now states that 10 per billion is the level of which they will act. How can we educate policymakers to get the safe level of water at zero?
I think one of the key points, particularly for kids in that critical brain development time period, is no lead exposure is safe. So as a matter of policy, as a matter of health policy, that's where we should be driving that number. I know there's legislation under consideration in Massachusetts looking at drinking water and at reducing the threshold to one. Not to zero, but to one. But mm-hmm. That's a huge improvement over the EPA's current standard of 15.
Yeah, and I think one of the big concerns legislators always have is if we put restrictions like that, it's going to cost more money to do whatever we need to do, to have a cleaner water supply, to remove lead from water, find alternative sources that cost money. But the flip side is having lead-poisoned children costs society a great deal of money, both in increased educational costs, decreased productivity costs in their lifetime of work. There are great costs to lead poisoning that are very underestimated because they're downstream costs, if you will, instead of immediate costs. And we have to focus on those when we think about trying to put tighter regulations in place to minimize lead exposure and lead poisoning.
I was just going to say, also, there is some funding available that that people can take advantage of. We have in New Hampshire currently three lead grants of $3 million each in the state. So there is money for property owners, landlords, or private homeowners who need to do this work or want to do this work and don't have the funding available. Also, you know, there's no substitute for education. You don't have to spend money for that. Obviously, you know, I teach classes that cost money, but there's also grant funding to cover the cost of those. And there's a lot of free information online. So, you know, get your house tested, get your kid tested, and get the information, I think, is the key.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is how much of this is an environmental justice issue.
I think it's very much an environmental justice issue, certainly nationally and in New England. Lower-income communities, racial minority communities are disproportionately affected. There's no question about that. That said, the issue does cross demographic lines. It's an urban issue. It's a rural issue. It's really a matter of, you know, where lead paint resides on walls and doors and windows, and it's everywhere. And so even, you know, in a well-maintained home with lead-based paint, all it takes is for a contractor who doesn't know what he or she is doing to come in and create an exposure, and you could have children who are poisoned. But I do think it is very much an environmental justice issue.
Right. So we should mention, too, that there are two home test kits that people can mm-hmm. buy at any, you know, hardware store or paint store and test themselves that are recognized by EPA. I mean, there are many other test kits, but the two that EPA has recognized as being effective are a product called Lead Check and a product called D-Lead. And I know on our website, and we can link to it for yours also, there's a little videotape that shows how to use them and what the packaging looks like and all of that that's, you know, readily accessible to folks. You don't necessarily have to spend a lot of money to find out what your situation is. These little test kits can show you, as long as you use them correctly. You do have to learn a little bit about how they work, but they're not difficult.
Thank you. We have another question here on, I think this is a very good question, is what steps can be taken to ensure that products with lead don't make their way into our homes? Is it mostly on consumers to know what they're buying, or are there new regulations that should be put in place? Very good question. That just left everybody stumped. So.
I think it's difficult with now you can buy something for anywhere in the world and get it delivered by Amazon within 2 days probably. And so it's a little tricky because I don't think there's great regulation on international purchases,
mm-hmm.
Stuff that's marketed and sold in the United States through U.S. companies and countries we deal with regularly. I think there are regulations, but I don't think it exists when you start. And for people who travel and bring things in from other places, and when you buy things at yard sales, you don't know where they're from. And so I think again, being suspicious of things with wooden painted surfaces, that especially if they're really shiny and hard, being suspicious of any pottery that doesn't look like it's got a national or some sort of company markings on it, that doesn't seem like there's a glaze over it you'd worry about, and just be careful with how you're going to use that as a serving utensil. I don't know, Tom, if you know of other ways to determine, apart from you could test
you can test with test strips,
yeah. But that's only a point in time as well.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think it is a real challenge with the global market.
I think to answer the question, it does fall on the consumer. It does, yeah. Unfortunately. But, you know, there are labeling laws, too. I have seen people come in to class with, mini blinds from China that they bought at the dollar store that say on the carton, lead hazard. So
right.
Read the carton. That's
yeah.
The first step, I guess.
Yeah. I believe we do have, and we probably have time for another question here. And I think we have somebody on the phone.
Yes, you do have a question from the line of Beverly Edwards.
Hi. I know that this is relatively, can you hear me?
Yes.
Relatively unpublicized information, but one of our pediatricians in the Boston area, Dr. Curtis Nordgaard, has been trying to get the word out to folks who have young kids, particularly under the age of 6, who might be considering getting on a natural gas line, to hold off from doing so because the radium-226 that comes out of Marcellus Shale and then turns into radon-222 and I guess devolves into lead eventually, they're very concerned about the cooking with natural gas in terms of what dust particles are formed and, you know, just as with lead, land on the floor. Concerned about respiratory problems and eventually lung cancer from the radon, which then gives the progeny of lead. So I am not a chemist by any means. I'm the chairman of a committee called, an ad hoc committee called the New Hampshire Energy Impacts on Health Study Group. But we're just looking into this because it seems to be a whole new area of concern. That's my comment.
I really appreciate your comment. I think that's what's so important about this discussion is information is so critical. I want to wrap up and give everybody an opportunity because people, want to get involved. How can they get legislation passed in their states? We've got legislation, I think, in New England and Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire right now around this issue. But just some final thoughts here for folks that have joined us today and how we address this issue, so if I could get around last words from everybody.
I really just think it's about awareness. I think our biggest problem is people don't know. I have great faith in human nature, and if you tell people the right information, you give people the right information and sources to find the information, they will do the right thing. You know, nobody poisons a kid on purpose. We just need to know. And so any opportunity that you have, the listeners have, or the folks who are watching this at some point, to go to our websites, to go to our Facebook pages, to use the free information that's out there, to invite us to come and speak to groups and so forth, please do that, because that's what's going to make the difference, in my opinion, is just getting the word out. And you're part of the Army.
I think from a practical perspective, for parents with young children, I'd say make sure your child gets tested.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we become a universal state and we do a better job at testing. But even if you live in a new home, my kids grew up in a newer home. It was built in the mid-90s. I still tested them because they go to other kids' homes. They go to grandma's house. They go to preschool. They go places besides your own home that may have lead in them because they might be older homes or other sources. So still have your child tested, even if you don't think they have a risk. I still would recommend getting tested. I'd recommend that if you live in an older home, think about testing areas of your home. But even if that's negative, still wipe down your flat surfaces, your horizontal surfaces, vacuum regularly, and wipe down windowsills, door jams, things like that, tabletops, because lead settles. It's a heavy metal. It's going to settle and just sit there until you remove it.
I think I'll just echo the theme of awareness. I think it's just really important for people to know what the hazards are, to know if they may have hazards within their homes, and to take appropriate actions. To help with awareness, that's one of the reasons we developed the website I mentioned, leadfreekidsnh.org. Obviously, it has a bit of a New Hampshire focus, but really only in name. The information there is universally helpful. So I would encourage people to use that as a good starting point resource. I'd encourage people to engage here in New Hampshire with our Senate Bill 247. I mentioned, you know, we've had some discussion around policy work at the state level, at the federal level. The last thing I want to mention is yesterday I attended a conference where the city of Claremont, New Hampshire, laid out what they are doing on lead, and it was really exciting and gratifying to see a municipality taking this issue very seriously and addressing the water issue, addressing the lead-based paint issue, addressing the screening issue. They've got their school district working with their municipal government. So they've developed a great model, and you know, I'd love to see that replicated.
Okay, thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you for everyone who called in today and who logged into Facebook to talk about this very important issue. And please, you know, go to clf.org, find out how you can get involved, get action alerts around this and many other topics. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.